You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. Hello and welcome to edition number 6 of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore and at Midori House in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. I'm your host, Ben Rylan. Coming up on the program, we'll wander the labyrinth of lanes in Melbourne to sample some of the city's famous small-scale coffee culture.
I mean, our main goal is high quality. Sometimes that means you've got to spend a lot of money to get that quality. And then being a business, you do want to have that marketing edge as well.
Then we're off to New Zealand, where a fall in dairy prices is proving tough for one of the country's core industries. And as a new brewery pops up in Tokyo, Kenji Hall and Fiona Wilson are lucky enough to pop in for a tipple.
Next one is called On the Cloud, 5.7% alcohol and still quite low on the bitterness scale.
Yeah, I'm liking this one. It's got a very good smell as well. I think as we're halfway through, I'm really starting to enjoy the beer. I don't know if it's just the alcohol or...
And later in the show, we'll look at how the issue of saving for retirement is proving to be a divisive political topic in Australia. All that plus a look ahead at the week in numbers, right here on Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is Asia Pac Unwrapped, where we take a closer look at the world's most dynamic region and explore emerging opportunities, whether it's places to invest, the finest destinations for a well-deserved break, or inspiring stories from the region's smartest business people. Let's start things off now with a look ahead at the week in numbers. Shoaib Kagda is the editor of Globe Asia, and he joins me on the line now from Jakarta. Shoaib, there's news out this week of the Indonesian government aiming to boost agriculture production while simultaneously improving public health. Now, that's in light of some estimates suggesting that up to 20 million Indonesians are considered undernourished. Tell us more about that.
Yes, you know, some latest statistics have just come out, and it seems that 20 million Indonesians go to bed hungry every day. The new president, President Joko Widodo, has made food security one of his top priorities. And just this week, the government announced that they are going to launch a program to subsidize seeds to farmers in an effort to improve and boost yields. That is very much welcome by farmers, but many agriculturalists are saying that that's not enough, and the government has to do more on boosting irrigation infrastructure, which over the past decade and a half hasn't really been improved, and many of the infrastructure that were built in the 70s, 80s, and part of the 90s have fallen into massive disrepair. So the subsidized seeds are welcome. Many people are calling for more effort from the government in terms of improving irrigation infrastructure.
And how is that likely, Shoaib, to impact the market as it stands right now? As you mentioned, it has been a bit of a problem with a bit of a lacking in maintenance and improving infrastructure over the past number of years.
You know, a lot of the food companies, of course, the larger food companies will look at this positively. But the small farmers, we will have to wait to see what the impact is on the small farmers, because many of them need irrigation and they don't have the funds to build these irrigation channels.
And are there concerns then if the government is putting too much funds into the market as it stands right now? Are there concerns that maybe it would become something that is publicly funded and publicly supported and perhaps can't sustain itself in the private sector?
Absolutely. You know, of course, you know, when it's publicly funded, generally out of every dollar, maybe only 80 cents actually goes down to the farmers. 20 cents disappears, you know, within the bureaucracy, and, you know, corruption is still rife in many parts of Indonesia. So the challenge, as you rightly say, is sustainability. Unless the private sector gets involved in a much bigger way, you know, once the funds run dry, then we're back to square one.
And moving along to another topic now, A.T. Kearney has released a report pointing to strong growth in the retail sector across Indonesia. Shoaib, what's pushing that one?
Well, you know, the rising middle class has been one of the greatest positive stories of coming out of Indonesia over the past decade. You know, Indonesia's middle class is now estimated at 50 to 60 million and estimated to reach 100 million by 2020. Now, this rising middle class, of course, is boosting spending in the retail sector. And the retail sector, we have seen the emergence of new players, the established players have been expanding. And AP Kearney just came out with a report that estimates the retail sector to be generating about $320 billion a year, which is pretty significant given that Indonesia's economy is at about $900 billion. So a third of the economy is now supported by the retail sector.
Thanks, Shoaib. We'll leave it there. Shoaib Kagda on the line from Jakarta, editor of Globe Asia. Up next, we'll sample the aroma of small coffee roasteries that are increasingly personifying Melbourne's coffee industry. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is Asia Pack Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. To many, the sunny shores of Australia are synonymous with endless summer days on the beach, barbecues, and wide open stretches of red desert. But head down to the country's cultural capital, Melbourne, and you'll discover an altogether different scene. Australia's southern metropolis has developed an enviable reputation as the nation's epicentre for A-class restaurants, bars, and produce. English superstar chef Heston Blumenthal has even relocated his iconic eatery, The Fat Duck, to the city for the first half of 2015. But long before Melburnians were enjoying dishes of salmon poached in a licorice gel with endive, the city was quietly humming away with a grassroots movement all of its own. During the arrival of Italian migrants throughout the 1940s, many Australians were treated to their very first sips of espresso. And so the seeds were planted of an industry that would blossom into a market worth about $4 billion. But as Starbucks painfully discovered a few years ago, the lucrative industry can be a tough nut to crack. Appealing to the discerning Melburnian calls for a distinctive blend of trendsetting sensibility and artisan skill. From little more than a hole in the wall on Melbourne's busy Exhibition Street, Darren Silverman has built one of the city's most treasured new establishments. Black Velvet Espresso enjoys meticulous control over its product, from sourcing the bean through to the roasting, grinding, and creation of the sought-after brew. And judging by the bulging crowds that flock outside the shopfront on any given weekday, there's no shortage of devotees. We sent Monocle contributor Stephen A. Russell to sample some of Black Velvet's espresso and ask Darren about how his approach to coffee differs to the bigger market players.
I worked with a lot of wholesale customers, and with that I found, working with a coffee company, that they were all offered certain things via the coffee company. Most of these things were things that they didn't want or need, and the things that they did want and did need were never on offer. What most of them really wanted was some help and some advice into how to make their coffee sales grow and stop spending money in areas that weren't making them any money. So we came up with this model here, which was high volume, lots of people in a city, people who didn't have the time to sit and therefore don't offer seats.
And you don't have to do that weekend work?
No weekends, 5 days a week. And a clientele that was in that sort of 30 to 50 year old bracket predominantly. And so we came up with this idea, and it was more about high volume, low overheads, minimal food, no kitchens, no chefs, none of the things that were eating up all your money. Mm. I mean, let's be honest, that's what cafes are. Yeah. They're a money pit.
Other than the Monday to Friday, is there something good about dealing with city customers in that they want to sneak out for their coffee break, you know, all the time? Is there a bit of a constant flow?
Yeah, we have an enormous amount of regular customers. There are very few that come once that don't become a regular customer. Mm. I love the fast in, out, stand, you know, standing room only type deal. Having said that, we run this like we run our wholesale business, which is very much a very family type feel to it. We know everyone, we know their names, they know my family, they know my kids. It's not unusual for them to come in here and step behind the bar if they want to. You know, we get asked questions all the time, how do you do this, how do you do that? I'd rather they just come around and have a look at them and how busy we are. Step behind the coffee machine and watch.
Stephen A. Russell there, enjoying the rich aroma of Melbourne's Black Velvet Espresso with owner Darren Silverman. Now, it's often said that Melbourne's coffee evolution is strictly an inner city phenomenon, and there's much truth to that. But as they say, rules are meant to be broken. Hopping on a train bound for Melbourne's Garden Vale, about 10 kilometres east of the city centre, Stephen sat down for a cup with Dean Atkins, the man behind Omar and the Marvellous Coffee Bird, a cafe and bean roastery with just as much curiosity as its name might suggest.
Omar is focused on buying high-grade quality coffee and providing that to the customers.
One of the things you sort of specialise in here is you bring some quite unique beans once in a while as well. Is that part of the mission, to give people new flavours that they haven't experienced?
That's right, yeah. So we do... I mean, our main goal is high quality. Sometimes that means you've got to spend a lot of money to get that quality. And then being a business, you do want to have that marketing edge as well. So to be brutally honest, sometimes we buy a coffee and the quality is very high, but we know that we're one of the first people who have actually gotten that coffee, and it is good for business because we can market that bean and market that grower, that farm, or the importer, or whoever it is doing a great job with that coffee. We can use that as part of our marketing. So what we do find is with those really expensive beans, if anything, we might make a loss off the beans because we do sell it to the customers pretty well at cost, because they won't buy it if it is marked up like our normal beans. But it is brilliant for business, brilliant for marketing, and it is a good story as well, generally.
And tell me about the team here, because you seem like a really small, you know, tightly knit team.
Yeah, we are. We only have 8 staff on the books. 5 of those are full-time, and then we have some casuals that do help us out. And we wanted to operate with full-timers, and look, they are, I suppose, you for the industry you would call them mature age as well, the staff, and they are mature, you know, and they do a great job for the business and they enjoy being here. I think if you have the right conditions for the staff, they do stay and they do look after the business, and it's worked really well for us.
That was Dean Atkins there, founder and owner of Melbourne's Omar and the Marvellous Coffee Bird, chatting to Monocle contributor Stephen A. Russell. Up next, we'll lift the lid on New Zealand's precious dairy industry. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
I'm Ben Ryland, and you're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Well, anyone who has ventured to the lush green hills of New Zealand will have a fair idea of how important the dairy industry is to the country's economy and, of course, cultural identity. And anyone resilient enough to have braved the queues at Lewis Road Creamery will have an even better idea of just how delicious that New Zealand milk can be when combined with the magic of chocolate. But global dairy prices have been falling in recent times, taking New Zealand's industry with it. Joining me now from Auckland is journalist Kate Goodsell. Kate, first off, give us a bit of background on how this is being felt across New Zealand.
Dairy prices, the global dairy price has quite a big impact on New Zealand. And every 2 weeks they have global auctions, so the dairy price fluctuates. And in the last 6 auctions, it's actually fallen. So it fell overnight for the 6th consecutive time, which is actually a bit of a surprise for some people because they were expecting it to firm a little bit. And although a lot of it's to do with the kind of the timing of the auction, because we're coming to the end of the New Zealand dairy season and coming into the Northern Hemisphere dairy season, so New Zealand producers are obviously competing with European producers as well. So it's quite important, because one of the key products in the global dairy auction is something called whole milk powder, which is used for infant formula. And New Zealand's actually the largest producer of whole milk powder in the world, and China is the largest importer of whole milk powder, and so they import about 90% of their whole milk powder from New Zealand. And that price fell 3.1%, and it's roughly halved in the last 2 years, so it does have quite a big impact on New Zealand.
So obviously the concept of dairy in New Zealand is quite important to the national economy there. Can you give us a bit of an understanding, maybe paint a picture of just how important it is?
Well, I mean, it's really quite hard to overemphasise how important dairy is to New Zealand. It's our biggest export earner. Dairy exports account for about a third of the country's merchandise exports. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which is our central bank, put that dairy exports at about $15.5 billion last year. That's New Zealand dollars. And to put that into some kind of context, our annual GDP is around the $200 billion mark. So that shows you how big it is. But it's not just that. It's that dairy is also, you know, because we've got a lot of producers and farmers, when a price falls, it has wider ramifications in the regions, because basically farmers aren't spending money, so that means that they're not spending money at the supply places, the people who run the supply places aren't spending money at the cafes, all that kind of thing. So you do see, when a price fluctuation happens, you do see literally billions of dollars drop out of the economy. On the other side, on the flip side, when prices go up, you see that kind of flow back into the economy, so it's pretty huge.
How do you see this one playing out going into the week ahead, Kate?
Well, into the week ahead, it doesn't have that much of an impact in the next sort of week, but in terms of in the next sort of couple of months in the oncoming season, the forecast payout has been lifted to $5.25, which is sort of at the break-even price for farmers to produce milk solids. So, and people are feeling probably a little bit more upbeat, because, you know, they're hoping, I guess, the demand will pick up, the New Zealand supply will come back on, and the European supply will taper out. And, you know, I mean, there may be changes to sanctions from Russia and things like that. So I think people, you know, try to remain optimistic. And the other thing to remember is that, you know, farmers are pretty resilient. They have dealt with commodity cycles all their lives, so they're kind of used to when there's a downturn, they've usually put a, you know, hopefully paid off a bit of that debt and can manage the servicing of their debt levels.
Thanks, Kate. We'll leave it there. Kate Goodsell joining us there on the line from Auckland. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. It's been common vernacular in Australia for some time now that the days of relying on the aged pension are all but over. But just how people go about saving for their retirement seems to be an endless game of political tennis. And as the country's federal election approaches next year, the issue looks set to play a leading role in how people vote. Earlier, Monocle's Carlotta Ribello spoke to journalist and commentator Karen Middleton in Canberra.
The issue of the cost of retirement incomes is a huge issue here in Australia. We had a federal budget handed down just a couple of weeks ago, and there were some changes made to the eligibility for the age pension. You know, there's a big culture in Australia of government safety nets in social security and in welfare, and there's a general sense among the aged population that, you know, there's an entitlement to an aged pension, but the take-up rate of that is fairly high, and the cost over time is huge. So the government is starting to try and address that into the future by curbing somehow the eligibility, and what they've started to do is to restrict who can claim the full pension depending on how much they have in assets other than the family home. The family home is protected from the assets test at the moment here in Australia, and that remains the case, but they've brought down the limit on the amount of assets you can have other than that before you start to lose part of your pension. And the other side of the pension discussion here in Australia in terms of the economy is relating to superannuation. We've got again, as part of that general philosophy, we've got a national contribution scheme for superannuation. So if you're an employer employing a person who earns above average wages, you have to pay a certain amount into superannuation for them every pay. And that means that people are guaranteed to have a private source of income when they retire. So there's an intersection, obviously, between the superannuation private income and the pension issue. The government offers very, very good concessions for paying money into your superannuation account yourself, and that means you get a tax reduction if you pay a certain amount into your own super account, and then you're supposed to draw down on that when you retire rather than resorting to the age pension. That's meant to save the government money, but there's been some debate about whether those concessions are in fact too generous to very wealthy Australians and not doing enough for people at the low end.
The Social Services Minister, Scott Morrison, has been one of the most vocal on these proposed changes. How does this fit with the wider national commentary on it? Is he at odds with his colleagues?
Well, interestingly, he is a little bit at odds with his colleagues. On the one hand, the government is saying, you know, that you should be preserving your superannuation, you should be putting as much money into it as you can, saving as much of it as you can. And on the other hand, Scott Morrison has been saying, don't use your superannuation as intergenerational wealth. And by that he means you shouldn't be putting superannuation away and then handing it on to your children as some kind of estate, you know, for when you pass away. So there is a slightly mixed message here. And the worry about that some in the superannuation industry are putting forward is that under Mr. Morrison's plan, you should be drawing down, not only drawing the interest from your superannuation, but drawing down from the principal as well as you retire to keep your income up, and that they're worried that this might mean that people will waste away some of their superannuation savings in order to still claim a part pension. So have a nice life in the early years of retirement, fritter away, if you like, some of that superannuation, and then still be eligible, come in under the threshold and claim a boost in their income from the pension. And there is a bit of an intersection, if you do the mathematics, where some people can end up actually worse off if they're relying on private savings than if they were just relying on the government pension. So there is a bit of confusion about the messaging from the federal government here at the moment.
That was journalist and commentator Karen Middleton there in conversation with our own Carlotta Ribello. This is AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we'll settle in for a beer or two with Monocle's Tokyo Bureau. You're listening to AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Now, the casual beer drinker will likely be quite familiar with the pub stablemate Asahi. Japan's leading brewer enjoys a 38% market share, slightly ahead of its closest rival, Kirin. But the world of Japanese beer has a lot more to offer than its leading double act. Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson discussed that with our Asia Editor-at-Large Kenji Hall over a sip of craft beer at the city's newly opened Spring Valley Brewery.
I think what's interesting about the tester here is that we have a sheet, an explanation sheet, that tells us everything we need to know about these six beers that are sitting in front of us. What they've done very, very well is they've lowered the bar for people who are not familiar with craft beer.
Yeah, people like me, you mean Kenji. I mean, I'm someone who doesn't drink beer and I really don't know the first thing about craft beer, so I'm the person this place is made for. And I have to say, we're surrounded by mothers with small children. I'm impressed that they're prepared to drink a lineup of beers while in charge of small children. But I think we're going to have a go at tasting, aren't we?
Yeah, they've very nicely laid these out in a way that we can go from light to heavy. So we'll start with one called Jazzberry, which is a fruit beer. And we'll end up at 496, which is an IPA, India Pale Ale style beer. So let's start off with the Jazzberry. More fruit than beer would be my call on that.
Yeah, mine too, which is exactly why I like it. I think it's got a very nice sort of fruity, almost slightly sharp taste. Yeah, I think for a beer drinker that's definitely too fruity. But for me, that's a good refreshing drink.
The next one is called Daydream. Very low in the bitterness scale, 4.9% in terms of alcohol. And this is done by the brewer Natsuko Tsumadori. Very light, sort of white beer with spices that you can taste the clove and cinnamon, maybe, in there.
Yeah, and I'm liking the fact that the bitterness is low. It's very easy to drink, which suits somebody like me, yeah. And yeah, pretty low on the alcohol, I see, as well, only a 4.9%.
Next one is called On the Cloud, 5.7% alcohol, and still quite low on the bitterness scale.
Yeah, I'm liking this one. It's got a very good smell as well. I think as we're halfway through, I'm really starting to enjoy the beer. I don't know if it's just the alcohol or the more I drink, the more I like.
The next one is called After Dark. It's a porter style beer. A little heavier on the alcohol, 6.1%. Distinctly coffee and chocolatey, and Fiona's making a face.
Not one of approval. No, this is definitely not my cup of tea, as it were. Yeah, just no for me. That's very dark. Yeah, it's very interesting. I think you're absolutely right. Slightly coffee-ish. They're all very, very different to me. It's not what I'm thinking of as a beer taste.
The next one is called Copeland, and this is an homage to William Copeland, who was the person who started Spring Valley Brewery in Yokohama in the 1870s. So Copeland is a 5.5% beer with a Czech Saaz hop in it, and it's, again, not that bitter. Not really my cup of tea.
I also ordered a margarita pizza. On the menu, they've got beer pairings, and the Copeland is the beer they recommend to have with the margarita. Well, I quite like it, Kenji. I think Kenji's a bit more demanding on the taste front than I am, but no, I think I quite like it. It's pretty light, and it's a very golden colour. It's a sort of classic look. The others have all been slightly different, cloudy or very dark, or the Jazzberry, which is positively raspberry in colour.
Lastly, we go to 496, which is an IPA-style beer, and this is the type of beer that normally I prefer. It uses a hop called Bravo, and it's the most bitter of all these beers that we're trying. And I imagine this is the one that Fiona will like the least. It's got a nice citrusy aroma, quite bitter. Not a bad effort, but it tastes a bit one-dimensional to me.
Very hard to please, Kenji. I'm actually getting a bit of lychee. Am I? This is just the alcohol talking, but I'm definitely getting some tropical fruits in there. Yeah, for me, that's a bit. It's a bit too alcoholic, a bit too bitter. It's not one for me. I can see that I'm definitely on the jazzberry end of the spectrum.
Any final thoughts on the lineup here? I'd say it's actually a very, very good effort to present a different side of the company. This is Kirin, which is one of Japan's biggest brewers, along with Asahi and Suntory. Just last fall, Kirin bought a company called Yoho Brewing, which is owned by Hoshino Resorts. They are the largest of the craft brewers in Japan. And so that was one of Kirin's entry points into this sort of craft brew market, which is growing at double-digit rates. The mass market beers have been declining in terms of production, in terms of sales. And so, you know, really what they're trying to do is they're trying to tap into this market that's growing. And I think very, very likely they will succeed.
Kenji Hall and Fiona Wilson from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau there, enjoying a couple of pints at Japan's Spring Valley Brewery. That brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Singapore, and by me, Ben Ryland, here at Midori House in London. Nina Norick was our editor. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington, and 2200 hours Sunday in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com, or of course tune in via iTunes, SoundCloud, or the handy little Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your week.